Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up today, an overview of Vatican II, a presentation and an explanation with a council expert, Spotlight Family Tree of Faith, telling the tale of the first of the great prophets of Israel, Elijah. But first, a Lenten reflection with Jesuit Father Gerald O'Collins by the title of The Good Samaritan. This parable was mentioned by Pope Francis recently when he was speaking about the sacrament of the anointing of the sick. He said that the profound mystery of the sacrament is expressed in a biblical icon, the parable of the Good Samaritan. Every time we celebrate the sacrament, he said, the Lord Jesus, in the person of the priest, is close to the one who suffers and is gravely ill or elderly. When the Good Samaritan tends to the victim of the robbers, the oil and wine he pours on his wounds represent the love and grace of Jesus for those who are suffering.
Dice la parabola che il buon samaritano si prende cura dell'uomo sofferente versando sulle sue ferite olio e vino.
Now we've briefly listened to the Pope's voice. Let's turn to Jesuit theologian and well-known author Gerald O'Collins.
Years ago, on an agreeable summer's evening in Sydney, I was walking down a suburban street with my sister and a female cousin of ours. At that time, my sister was a social worker, a cousin a nurse, and I had just been ordained a priest. As we walked along, we came across a man sitting on the footpath. His feet were dangling in the gutter, and his body gently swaying backwards and forwards. The strong smell of spirits caught us as we went by. Half an hour later, the three of us came back along the same street. Some paramedics were loading the man on board their ambulance. He was drunk all right, but he'd been sitting down because a car had hit him, broken his leg, and failed to stop. We've just repeated the parable of the Good Samaritan, my sister commented. Only this time, instead of a priest and a Levite passing by on the other side, it's been a case of a priest, a social worker, and a nurse passing by on the same side. How right my sister was, and how practical and demanding Jesus is in his parable of the Good Samaritan. He wants us to stop and help any neighbours in distress that we come across on the road of life. Jesus himself was totally at the service of others, of those who desperately needed him and his help. He was the Good Samaritan in person. He stopped to heal our wounds and carry us to safety. In the parable he told, the Good Samaritan put the wounded traveller up on his donkey and then walked ever so slowly, holding the man on the saddle, until they reached the inn further down the road. It was a generous and a dangerous thing to do. Bandits had struck once when they wounded and robbed the traveller. They could easily have been waiting to strike again around the next corner. And who is more vulnerable than a man holding a wounded person in the saddle and walking along ever so slowly beside a donkey? In stopping to help and heal us, Jesus did a most generous thing and a most dangerous thing, and they did come for him. This Good Samaritan stopped a wounded people and was struck down, wounded, and killed himself. Jesus paid for his real love with his own life. Yes, the parable of the Good Samaritan is a terribly demanding story. It calls on us to get involved at any time and with anyone who desperately needs our help. That parable sets the standard awfully high. But we have this comfort. Jesus himself lived out that parable to the uttermost, and he's always there to give us the strength and help we need to put his words into practice.
And our thanks there go to Australian Jesuit theologian and well-known author Gerald O'Collins. Moving on in the broadcast, I'd now like to bring you an overview of the Second Vatican Ecumenical Council, with Jesuit historian and author of A Short History of the Councils of the Church, Professor Norman Tanner. I spoke to him in an effort to better understand this groundbreaking council, which took place half a century ago. But without giving too much away, why don't you listen to my conversation with Professor Tanner? Father Norman Tanner, in your book, A Short History of the Councils of the Church, you say that when John XXIII announced on January 25th, 1959, less than 3 months after his election, that he wished to convoke a new ecumenical council, there was considerable surprise. Why, in a sense? Because, I mean, this was old hat discussion. His two predecessors, the See of Peter, had already discussed this at length. So it shouldn't have come as a surprise. I mean, a century had gone by since Vatican I.
That's right. Vatican I, which is principally known for the definition of papal infallibility in 1869-70, was incomplete. It was ended forcibly when Roman troops entered the city. But the Pope of the time, Pius IX, never formally concluded the council. It was postponed. So right the way through the early 20th century, there was a possibility that it would be reconvoked. And it's true that Pius XI, we know Pius XII, considered, but rather privately and certainly not publicly, that Vatican I might be re-summoned. So when John XXIII was elected in October 1958, that sort of possibility was still there. But nevertheless, it came as a surprise when, as you said, in January 1959, only 3 months after he was elected, Pope John XXIII announced that there would be this council. I say this council because actually at that moment it wasn't quite clear whether it would be a new council or whether, as you indicated, it would be a continuation of Vatican I. However, John XXIII fairly quickly made it clear that Vatican II would be a new council and it would not be a formal continuation of Vatican I.
Am I right in saying that John XXIII was considered, in a sense, to be a conservative pope? So it was an unlikely gesture because of that.
Well, that's right. It certainly came as a surprise. John XXIII was, I think, 77 when he was elected, and you might say he was expected to be a caretaker pope. And this new initiative, that's right, certainly was not expected.
As you mentioned in your book on the history of the Catholic Church, the Apostolic Constitution Humanae Salutis outlined its aim. What was the aim exactly?
Yes, well, as you mentioned, although in January 1959, John XXIII indicated he wished to call this new council, but it was not till 1961 that the council was formally summoned. And he spoke in fairly general terms about renewing the church, both in terms of presentation of doctrine and in its moral life and discipline. So it was quite a general announcement of the council and without entering into specifics. Aggiornamento was the word he used on occasion, but there was no huge doctrinal crisis which required the calling of a council, as happened in the early church with Nicaea or Chalcedon and so on. So that's correct that John XXIII announced the council without a clear program.
You talked about aggiornamento for our listeners. That means renewal, no?
Renewal, yes. Well, aggiornamento literally means in Italian, giorno, aggiornamento, bringing up to date, bringing up to day. So it's updating.
How did the council eventually develop? John XXIII died in 1963, and Paul VI, who succeeded him, found himself spearheading a council that they say he would never have called.
Well, that's right. The council began officially on the 11th of October 1962. There were 70 documents prepared by the Roman Curia. John XXIII entrusted the preparation of the council to the 10 commissions, which were much influenced by the 10 congregations of the Roman Curia. And they prepared, following John XXIII's wishes, preparatory documents, and they numbered some 70 in total. Some were completely written out, others were in sketch. However, once the council began with approximately 2,500 bishops who were the core members of the council, these decrees, which had been prepared as drafts, were basically not accepted by the council. And so the council, the members of the council, had to begin almost all over again.
Why did this happen? Why weren't they accepted?
Well, there was a variety of reasons. We have 2,500 individuals here, and it is not right to try and categorize them too precisely, especially into conservatives or progressives. But anyway, they felt that these prepared documents, 70 fairly short documents, and that those the ones that they were able to see, as it were, that those had actually been prepared in draft, did not fit what they expected of the council. And John the 23rd himself went along with this wish to start from scratch again. He did not insist on the council pushing through these prepared decrees. So the early days of the council, the early weeks, so it was summoned for this first session from 11th of October to the middle of December 1962. And initially the assumption was that the council would finish its work within those 10 weeks. But when the decrees that been prepared were found to be unacceptable to the bishops and other members of the council, the council had to begin rather all over again. And it soon became clear that this one session, this one period of 10 weeks, would not be sufficient. And so towards the end, John the 23rd, Pope, announced formally that there would be another session of 10 weeks in the following autumn of 1963.
You speak about some of the figures that emerged as being perhaps progressive or conservative. Well, you're very vague about that. But what I'd like to know is who some of the leading figures were that emerged from this council.
Well, there were leading figures, that's right. Well, I say some hesitation about conservatives and progressives, because, of course, the progressives, as we call them, who made up the majority, you might say, as the decrees came out, in many ways they were to consider themselves as conservatives. They wished the church to go back to its roots, to its early period, the early first four or five centuries of the church. So they were not happy with the idea that they were simply avant-garde. And likewise, the groups who were called the conservatives certainly did not see themselves as simply going backwards. They felt that the church, which had been given to them, given to us by Pius XII and so on, was the best way for the church to confront the challenges of the second half of the 20th century, and to change things radically would be dangerous and counterproductive.
But names?
Some names. Well, the four people who eventually, the four bishops, cardinals, who eventually had the greatest responsibility for guiding the council, Cardinals Leccaro and Dörfner and Swainens from Belgium. The fourth was Cardinal Agagianian from Armenia. They played a crucial role. Bishops were discreet, and they led as members of their countries, and often it was the primate of the country who was particularly influential. Obviously, the two popes played a crucial role, although discreetly. They did not come to the sessions of the council, or very, very rarely, but both John the 23rd and his successor, who was elected in the summer of 1963 after John the 23rd passed to the next life, they played a very active and discreet role in the running of the council, while allowing the council to have very considerable liberty to proceed in its own way. Amongst the leaders, very important were the theologians. So each bishop was allowed to bring a theologian with him, normally a priest. And also there were a number of others who were appointed more directly by the Pope. And certainly the three most influential theologians, periti they were called, experts, were the Dominican Yves Congar, the Jesuit Karl Rahner, both very well-known figures, of course, and also less well-known, Monsignor Philips from Belgium, who was a crucial figure because he had the confidence of both the, what you might call, the progressives and the more conservatives. And he was a crucial figure in getting decrees, especially key documents, the decree on the church and other key decrees, making them acceptable to the more conservative minority. He was a skilled politician. He'd actually been a senator in the Belgian Senate before and joining the council, and he was a very skilled negotiator. Monsignor Philips had a stroke shortly after the ending of the council, and so after the council he did not become the well-known figure that Congar and Rahner became, and indeed had been before the council. So he is a more discreet member, but undoubtedly one of the three most influential of the periti theologians.
A worldwide representation like this had never been seen before in the history of the Catholic Church, but how balanced was it really? I mean, most of these people came from Europe, no? Most of these theologians or bishops.
Certainly it was the most worldwide by a good deal. Vatican I, or even Trent, you might say, with representatives, but Vatican I, bishops from all over the world, but nevertheless, most of those from outside the Western world were of European descent, so either directly of European descent or European missionaries. 700 altogether, some 750 altogether at Vatican I, whereas we have 2,500 bishops at Vatican II. Well, it's true, certainly the early initiatives in the Council came from bishops and theologians, the ones I've just mentioned, really, predominantly, overwhelmingly, from northwestern Europe, that is to say, France and Germany and Belgium, the Netherlands, and also Italy paid its contribution in that way. So for the first 2 years of the Council eventually went on for 4 years, that is true. But nevertheless, we have indigenous bishops from the rest of the world for the first time, so Africans, Asians, Indians, and so on. And particularly, you might say, during the first 2 years, they gained their confidence, and undoubtedly they played an active and formative role in the Council, especially from the second, third, fourth years. We might think of the African cardinals, Zoa, Maluba, if I get the name right, and as well as bishops from Indonesia and India and, of course, South America and so on. So the wider world bishops and also theologians from those countries, but particularly the bishops, played a significant part in the determining of the final 16 documents which eventually emerged from the Council.
So from what you're saying, the universality of the Church was visible for the first time in history in a Council like this. But you spoke about the role of the papacy. If you had to put a stamp on Vatican II, would it be more John the 23rd or more Paul the 6th?
Well, surely the Council was called, and as we said at the beginning, to the surprise of many, by John the 23rd. So his stamp, particularly you might say, in allowing the Council to have freedom and to move on from the decrees which had been prepared to new ones. Also in the sense that John the 23rd always wanted it to be a pastoral council, a council which would make the Christian message relevant to the second half of the 20th century, aggiornamento in that sense. The last of the 16 documents to be approved, the Gaudium et Spes, the Church in the Modern World, that indirectly very much followed his wish that the council should be a pastoral one which would proclaim the Christian message in the language of the second half of the 20th century. So John 23rd, undoubtedly very important, crucial. Equally, Pope Paul VI, who was elected in the summer of 63, following the death of John the 23rd, played a crucial and extremely skillful role in bringing the council to a successful conclusion. So when John the 23rd passed, the council, you might say, was in some confusion. The prepared decrees had been turned down, and although there was beginning to think about the new decrees, they were in no way in final shape. So Paul the VI had this very difficult task of taking over from where the council was left. With great astuteness and skill, he not only presided over the second session in the autumn of 1963, but then allowed the council to have two more 10-week sessions in the autumns of 64 and 65, and with great skill managed to bring the council to a successful conclusion at the end of that fourth period in the autumn of 1965 with the 16 decrees. So it was indeed a monumental achievement on the part of both popes.
In your opinion, with hindsight, have the decrees that went beyond Christianity and the Catholic Church been more influential than those that affect Christianity?
I think both. The Council undoubtedly initially was thought to be mainly about the organization of the Church within and broadening Vatican I into a consideration of Catholic Church in particular. And we have that clearly in the core document, Lumen Gentium, which fills out what Vatican I had begun. But then undoubtedly the Council is extremely important because it went on first to speak in a very positive way, as well as acknowledging the difficulties, the other Christian churches, other Christian communities. And then, of course, went beyond that in its decree on non-Christian religions, a very short document, but nevertheless one which spoke in a positive way about the other great world religions, Judaism, Buddhism, Hinduism, Islam in particular. So that was a very significant, important a development and a change of, or development at any rate, change of atmosphere of Catholics towards other religions. And finally, I think very important, Gaudium et Spes, the final document, which we've already mentioned, Church in the Modern World, explicitly addressed itself to all people in the world, everybody, and that too was a new development for a decree of an ecumenical council to have a whole document, a substantial document, which was directed to the world at large, to the whole human population.
The whole idea of the Second Vatican Council was forward-looking, yet its legacy doesn't seem to be very visible today. Would you agree?
Well, I think all the councils, and we know we have 21 ecumenical councils, all of them were forward-looking. Many of them had to deal with a particular issue of the time, maybe a crisis, but certainly they were all there to help the Church into the future. But that's true, that's right. I think Vatican II in a particular way, and the Gaudium et Spes, the last decree, but all of them were trying not only to bring the Church up to date in the 1960s, as it were, but to help the Church into the immediate future. But you're also right, that's right, that it was a council which proved to be difficult to receive. Reception is the technical word, yes, reception. And nevertheless, perhaps we should not be too surprised about that. All the councils, I've mentioned 21, we might have five or six exceptionally important. We think of Nicaea I in the 4th century, Chalcedon in the 5th, the great medieval council, Lateran IV and Trent. All of them, well, at least the first two anyway, in the early church, they had difficult receptions. And so there's nothing to be surprised that the reception of Vatican II has taken time to be digested, although perhaps I agree that it's a bit disappointing that it's proved more difficult than one might have wished, because the decrees, if you look at the voting, had the overwhelming support of the bishops, even though obviously some had reservations about certain aspects, but nevertheless the voting was overwhelming. I suppose one of the problems was that the mechanism for putting the council into practice was not so immediate and direct as it would have been for certainly the medieval councils or Trent. Those councils, the medieval councils, were councils called by the papacy directly. There was, you might say, the papal mechanism for putting them into practice. Likewise with Trent, the papacy was fully behind Trent and indeed established a congregation of the Roman Curia explicitly for the interpretation of the council, so that if there were any difficulties, here was an organ which could resolve them. Those two councils had the very full backing of the papacy, the Roman Curia. I think Vatican II, surely the papacy gave its full support to the council. I think members of the Roman Curia, some of them, a significant number, would have been amongst the minority who had serious reservations about how the council might be going and its interpretation. So it's true that the council did not have the Curia, which was a crucial part, would find it more difficult to put some of the decrees into practice with full enthusiasm. So I think it's a combination of that, the Roman end, with justified, no doubt, reservations about what was going on. And then at the other end, the bishops, they had to do it sort of individually. And it's true that some of the interpretations or some of the practices were irresponsible, you might say. We know that a very large number of priests left the priesthood, same with religious orders. It was a difficult time after Vatican II, which had given great encouragement to many things, but then people would say, well, that it was leading to disintegration, etc. So the euphoria of Vatican II itself then had to face the realities of human life, human difficulties. But despite the difficulties, the Vatican II has been behind so much of the movement in the Church since, and undoubtedly is a defining moment for the Church in the last century.
You were listening there to Jesuit historian and author of A Short History of the Councils of the Church, Professor Norman Tanner. Finally, in this Sunday's Gospel, we hear of Jesus relating to many characters from our family tree of faith, including Moses and Elijah. I may be wrong, but my feeling is that most people know about Moses and fewer about Elijah. So why not bring you this story from our family tree of faith as recounted for us by scripture scholar Mark Benedict Coleridge, currently Archbishop of Brisbane in Australia.
Let me introduce you now to the first of the really great prophets of Israel. I say he's a prophet, but in fact he looks rather like Gandalf, I think, the good wizard from the Lord of the Rings. There's more than a touch of the magical, a touch of the wizard about the prophet we know as Elijah. Now, like Gandalf, we know almost nothing of his background. He's called a Tishbite, but we're not sure what Tishbites were. He bursts onto the scene as a prophetic leader. He's a leader of a band, and they must have been a band of rough-and-ready prophets, but they're called the Sons of the Prophets, these wild men who leap out of nowhere and stand eyeball to eyeball with the king above all. And this was Elijah's role. Elijah stood eyeball to eyeball with Ahab, and even more particularly in some ways, with Ahab's extraordinary wife, Queen Jezebel. Elijah stands up as the defender of the God-given identity of Israel, which was a community of slaves set free. And what he says to Ahab and to Jezebel is, you are taking us back to Egypt. You are leading the people back to slavery because you're undermining the God-given identity of our people. Now, the man is miraculously cared for by God, the God who has called him to this task. He's fed by ravens, for instance, in a time of famine, not unlike St. Benedict up there at Subiaco. He also has miraculous powers. He feeds the widow of Zarephath when she has nothing to eat. He even raises her son from the dead. He seems to have gone on very well with the widow of Zarephath, who offered him accommodation. He also calls down lightning regularly to consume his opponents. In fact, he's rather a dangerous man who seems always to be calling down fire. And this is because in the Bible, the holy is always dangerous. Handle with care. And this was certainly the case with Elijah. Cross his path and you pay a fierce price. This fierce character who can call down fire is also the man who in the cave can listen to the voice of God that is not in the great fire or the ferocious wind or the great earthquake, but who can hear what the Hebrew text calls the voice of a thin silence and know that it's the voice of God. So he's a man who can listen to the silence as well as call down the fire. Eventually, at the end of his long and stormy prophetic career, during which, I might add, he wrote absolutely nothing, not a word, but at the end of this long and stormy career, we're told, he's carried up to heaven in a whirlwind. The chariot of fire, we're told, arrives from nowhere, and into the chariot of fire gets the prophet Elijah, and he's carried up to heaven, leaving only his cloak, his magic cloak, as it were, because he could strike the river Jordan with his cloak and it parted, like Moses at the Red Sea. He leaves his magic cloak to his successor and, in many ways, his son, the prophet Elisha. The tradition then is that he never died, and from this there came the tradition that he would return one day. And, in fact, he's found on page after page of the New Testament, there next to Jesus. On the mountain of Tabor, at the Transfiguration, we find the prophet Elijah with Moses talking to Jesus. There was a tradition that he would return before the Messiah came, before the great day of the Lord that the Messiah would bring. And some people said, well, is John the Baptist Elijah? And there were even people who said, well, perhaps Jesus is Elijah. In fact, he remains the great first prophet. In some ways, he's the archetype of the prophet, who could stand up to the powers that be and speak with the fire of God. So, if walking down the Via della Conciliazione you see a fiery chariot coming towards you, you know that it's probably the prophet Elijah and that the day of the Lord is at hand.
That was scripture scholar Mark Benedict Coleridge, currently Archbishop of Brisbane in Australia. I hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks for listening. Laudetur Jesus Christus.